This is Chris Evans with a Storage Unpacked podcast, and I'm joined here this week by Martin. How are you doing, Martin?
Yeah, not too bad. How are you, Chris?
Pretty good. Yes. Keeping away from everybody. I don't want to be catching anything contagious.
I've just spent the afternoon doing pandemic planning, so yeah.
Oh, right. Okay. Wow. Interesting. Yeah, let's move on from that. Let's hope we never have to see that being used. And we are joined this week by a guest. We've got Kyle Davis from Redis Labs. Hi, Kyle. How are you doing?
I'm great. Glad to be here.
Would you like to give everybody a little bit of an introduction to yourself and just say what you do for the company?
Yeah, sure. I'm the head of developer advocacy at Redis Labs. And in that job, what it is basically I work with developers to help them understand our product, the database, and what they can do with it, and you know, what the features are and maybe what those features can do for them.
So the name of the company, Redis Labs, is obviously derived from the fact that you have a product called Redis.
That's right. That's right.
Okay. So Redis is a key value store now. And let me just explain that. We've talked about key value stores on and off a little bit in the podcast over the last, the last few weeks in reference to other things. So we know that there's a few products now that are starting to use key value stores at the back end. But actually, that's not what you're doing. You've got an actual platform that's used as a key value store as part of an application sort of process.
That's right. Yeah. So we derive from the kind of branch of databases that are key value stores. What that means is that any data at some atomic level can be accessed by effectively a key or somewhat like a primary key in a relational database. And then there's something on the other side of that, whether that be one structure or another, or maybe even a different type of actual storage that you might be using that might be a little bit richer than just a standard key value store. So that's where it comes in. And the whole idea is that the key is kind of the heart of how you access data.
Okay, well, let's dig down into a bit more depth there. But before we do, I just want to say to Martin, because I like my little mainframe references every so often, and key value store is actually a key sequence data set from VSAM. Martin, you remember those?
Oh, I do. VSAM, ISAM, things like that. Yeah, way back in the day.
Yeah, VSAM was, and especially KSDSs, were pretty awful because you had things called control intervals and control areas, which controlled how you split up the data when you inserted content that wasn't in line with the actual keys. So I'd imagine the implementation that IBM had on the mainframe was pretty basic compared to what we have now. So we'll dig down and understand exactly what it means and explain to people how, you know, from your perspective, Kyle, you implement it in your product. But in terms of key value, we're talking about a database that is basically made up of pairs of data, a descriptive part, and then a value itself. I mean, that's the ultimate sort of definition, isn't it, really?
Yeah, that is. There's kind of another layer to it. And are we a key value store? Well, we kind of stretch the limits of what a key value store really is. The strictest level, yeah, exactly what you're describing. But there's another layer in Redis, which is the data structure. So that kind of informs how the data is being stored. So instead of the data just being a sequence of bytes, there's actual structures that you can use and access and insert data into that are associated with that key. So it's kind of like a key value store, and then it kind of expands that definition a little bit.
Okay, so typically then, would you expect a key value store to be a persistent type of structure, or can it be both persistent and running in memory?
Yeah, so Redis has this concept of making everything tunable, right? So we have the ability to be entirely durable to disk, but natively we're in memory. So what that means is when you're storing something, everything goes into RAM as its first point of entry into the system. So a lot of databases work this way, but we kind of have this as at the heart of our system, you know, down to the point where you can access individual bits and manipulate bits inside some data structures. This is where you're accessing it, but we also provide the options for you to be able to write that to disk in a durable way that if the power does happen to go off for whatever reason, you can restart the server and it's restart to either a known point or to the last written point. So it provides a whole range of options there.
Okay. Martin, the most obvious one I can think of as a comparison to this in terms of when we talk about key values is when we talk about object stores, and we talk about storing key value pairs with objects, don't we? That's probably about the most common usage I think we would talk about it in storage.
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting one, though, isn't it, Chris? Because object stores, it's key value stored, but they're not very fast. Whereas the whole point of things like Redis is it's in memory database, so it's going to be really fast.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So, but I was using the term really to sort of, I guess, put into people's mind this idea of, if you think about key values, you might think about, say, a name, a surname and a value, and, you know, a full name and a value, a date of birth, or it might be in something like an object store, the date changed. Those are the sorts of pairs we mean. But obviously, we know we can get more complex than that. But you're right. There's a very good reason why you would want to run something like Redis, because you want something that's much more highly performing than typically just storing it in a sort of transactional database. Yeah. It would be a bit of overhead doing that. So let's talk about why you would even do this then, Kyle. What sort of use cases do we see people coming up with?
Yeah, sure. You know, Redis is used really, really widely, and it's sometimes referred to as kind of like a Swiss Army knife. So what use cases? That would be a long list. One of the typical things, though, that we see people using, and we're often used as a cache to be in front of a slower database. But, you know, that's what we're somewhat known for. But in reality, our customers use us most frequently for session storage. So storing user data between sessions, where that data has to be retrieved and written potentially every time a view on an application is accessed. So that is something that has to be at very highly performant, because it, you know, if it is at all latent, or if it is all at all has a, you know, a limited throughput, then that's going to affect the overall performance of your application.
Okay, so you could use it for sake of argument, as you said, for somebody who's logging on to an application which can they continually need to use that session, and you need to be able to retrieve that at memory speed. You yep. don't want to be doing a database lookup to find out the session data effectively.
That's right.
And I guess that's why you can afford to say that it sits in memory rather than reading it from disk, because worst case, if you've lose that session as part of a reboot or something like that, I guess you're not going to worry too much that data goes away. But there are obviously going to be some scenarios where you do want to keep that data persistent.
Absolutely. To the point that people rely on Redis to a degree that, you know, it's at the heart of their application. And if they lose it, you know, that would mean a whole lot of things that they'd have to repopulate, and they may not have time in a really critical point to be able to do that. So we have a lot of people that provide one of our layers of durability in it. For example, we have different layers here, but you can have something that's entirely ephemeral that is, you know, if the power turns off, then you have to repopulate it from zero. But then there's a kind of a middle way where you have a snapshot, and that's captured every second, let's say, or every minute. And then you only lose that, you know, whatever the maximum would be, maybe a minute or a second worth of data. And that's really good for this type of use case, especially as you get into e-commerce. We're frequently used to store the cart on e-commerce applications. So, you know, a user would be pretty miffed if they lost a minute worth of shopping, even because they thought that the sneakers or whatever were in their shopping cart, and there's a blip on the website, and then sneakers are gone. So people tend to really want to, you know, be able to have this in some durable fashion.
Yeah, I guess that's a use case where you could write that data in the background while they've added something to the cart, and they're not going to notice if it flushes to disk every second or 5 seconds, yeah. But they probably would care if it was lost after a few minutes. Yeah,
that's right.
Makes sense. Yeah, it makes sense. Yeah. Martin, do you use key value stores like this at all?
Yeah, we do. But the whole key value store and the NoSQL thing is, yeah, there's a lot of them used. I know things like Redis are used. I also know that developers have a habit of trying to write their own as well, because they think because from a data model, it's quite simple. So people think they can do it better. But yeah, but we definitely use key value stores.
Okay, so let's dig in and talk about what we mean by, you know, data model and the sort of data we're storing. Clearly, Kyle, you can store more than just simple constructs.
That's right.
Within that. So can you just sort of take us through what sort of data people could store and what that might look like?
Yeah, so just to kind of relate off the last example that I used, when you're using a cart, you're going to have a list of items, but you might also have in a session alongside that cart maybe some preferences or some things that they might need to know, like what your postal code is or something along those lines. So in that case, we use what's called a hash map on top of that. So that's just a series of fields and values that are associated with a single key. So that's a really common data structure that we have. But we also have things like linked lists, which are pretty common at CS 101, but they're often used to kind of construct queues, which is also a key use case for us. We have, you know, some more exotic things as well. Of course, we have sets, which are not exotic at all, but kind of related to those, we have some probabilistic data structures that allow you to do very compact estimations of size or estimations of some properties of data. And then beyond that, we have the ability for people to write their own modules, which enhance Redis to do different things. So some of those modules, for example, are an entire graph database or a full-text search engine. We also have a time series database and a proper document store. So if you wanted to store JSON, you can manipulate that JSON at the database level.
I think we might have underdone it by saying just talking about key value stores there at the very beginning, because the idea of being able to hold linked lists or even sets in memory is actually quite a complex structure in itself. And if you think about, say, somebody who might be writing some code in any of the high-level languages, or even something as simple as C, taking that away from the programmer and making it more either abstracted, consistent, sitting in a resilient form, actually, I guess, significantly simplifies programming in that sense.
Yeah. You know, this is one of the things that developers tell us quite frequently, is that they basically use Redis because it's how they think about their own applications. So they might think, I need a linked list. Well, they can use a Redis list instead, and then you have effectively the same thing, but it's on a centralized server that could also be distributed as well and reside in a massive cluster. So there's a huge advantage to being kind of using these fundamental concepts and data structures in a way that you don't have to think about, let's say, marshalling or unmarshalling that data into your own versions of those, and you don't have to think about, you know, having to implement a linked list at all. So this provides a lot of value in that way, and it really speeds up development for a lot of people.
Mm. That's an interesting angle, Martin, that I hadn't really thought about with, say, microservices. I don't know about you, but it just suddenly dawned on me as I was thinking that through, that if you're writing a large monolithic application, you do your own memory management, you build your own in-memory data structures. But as you start to break things down into a more microservices type architecture, you possibly want to offload some of that memory management data structures functionality to something like Redis. And that seems like quite a logical approach, I guess.
Well, yeah, I can see it with microservices. I can see it as functions as a service as well. You're not interested in that memory management. That all gets handed off to, in this case, Redis. So.
Yeah, and you're getting the benefit as well, that you're getting that resiliency as well. So you're getting those other things that go with it. So actually, it's quite an interesting sort of position it's sitting in that I hadn't really sort of, you know, thought through. Mm-hmm. Interesting. So is that a typical example, Kyle, of where people might use it? They would look at it and say, you know, when they're running microservices, this allows them to, you know, place that data structure somewhere where it can A, be shared, and B, you don't have to think about it when you're writing that code.
Absolutely, and you see that quite a bit, especially as you get into things like providing queues or through our streams data structure, which is another one that we have that's relatively new, where it's basically a time-ordered set of keys, or excuse me, fields and values that you can use. And that's really great for maintaining state, actually, in a microservices environment. So we do see this happening more often. It's something that with people who are using a microservices architecture, they are probably implementing those services using Redis at some level, because, you know, with a microservices architecture, you really have this problem of latency. If you have 12 services in your microservices architecture, and each one is being, you know, talking to another one through something else, you have this kind of a, you know, compounding latency problem. So either people are using Redis as a cache to prevent that compounding latency problem, or they're actually using it to communicate with the different services by having writing things out to those and then having another microservice read those pieces from the stream. So you still are maintaining, you know, your isolation of your data, because this actually becomes an interface. And I'm glad you brought that up. It's we just finished a book. It's published by Wiley. It's called Redis Microservices for Dummies. Myself and one of my colleagues wrote that book.
The classic For Dummies series, yeah, there's so many of those, aren't there? But I guess they do give you that level of introduction to it, which is always quite interesting.
Yeah.
So I can imagine a scenario then, as we get into more complex data, that this makes complete sense. But who typically does the management and deployment of that key value store in the first place? Would you expect the developer to do it, or would you see that as being done by more of an operations type team?
Yeah, you know, that's more dependent on the type of organization that's running it. You might have something like, you know, the organizations that have rather large structures around their organization. So something like a bank, for example, will definitely have an operations team that maintains the Redis instances and maintains running them. But you also have situations where you have smaller startups as well that Redis is really easy to run, and you don't need a whole lot to run it as far as you know, both knowledge and a whole lot of ongoing maintenance with it. So it certainly is fair that we see developers maintaining it. And you know, I come from kind of the development background where I shunned as much operations work as I could. And I you know, before I joined Redis Labs, I kept a Redis instance running, and I just kind of forgot about them. It's just, it kind of runs for forever if you have it in the right environment. And it takes up very little resources as well. So, you know, an open source Redis instance takes only about 6 megabytes of overhead. So, you know, you can, it's so small that it becomes a rounding error in the amount of RAM that you're using as far as overhead. But your data, of course, will take a lot more space up than that because you are storing things in RAM.
Okay, and typically how would you deploy this then? Would you just run it as a background task on an existing server? Would it run as a microservice in a container itself? What's the sort of typical deployment model?
Well, you know, we had far over a billion deployments of Redis in Docker, on Docker Hub. So that's a very common proof point. But we also see people running it in a very variety of ways. You know, people generally start out with it being something that they run on the same virtual machine as a web server or some sort of application logic. But as they grow, they run it in a cluster itself, right? So Redis Enterprise, for example, which is kind of the commercial offering of Redis, it provides a lot of the features you'd want to have to run it at scale. So it kind of becomes very self-managing in the fact that you can you know, give it a set of resources and it will allocate appropriately how to use those resources. And then you have people who are running, you know, manually running big clusters of the open source Redis, where they're really paying a lot of attention to that. And then they have applications connecting to it in various ways through DNS servers and all sorts of fun things. So there's a whole variety there. You know, it's one of those things where people start using it, they find that it's quite useful. And this is my direct experience when I started using Redis about 8 years ago. I just started running it as something to solve a couple of problems where I had a few processes that need to access the same information. And then as I started to use it more, you start going into the cluster area, and then you realize that it becomes really entrenched and really key in your performance strategy for your applications. And then you start going into you know, something like an enterprise cluster that has multiple different isolated databases from both a data plane and from administrative plane isolation, all the way to having, you know, maybe dozens and dozens and dozens of nodes that have themselves each dozens of shards on each node.
Okay, so when you say shards, obviously, I guess we're talking about the fact that you can deploy this in a scale-out model, and you are sharding both for protection and for distributing the load, I guess.
That's right. That's okay. Right. There's some other things that you can do as well to meet those needs, but the traditional setup in a cluster would be that you would have a shard would represent one fraction of the data set, and then they would be spread across nodes for things like high availability and all those different properties that you want for running something in a performant and really highly available way. You'd want to have everything there that you'd have in a given cluster. And then on top of things, you would also have a different data plane, which you would be managing that. So you have your data plane and you have your management plane that you're doing two different operations on. So you can bifurcate it so your ops team doesn't need to necessarily access the data, and your application team doesn't need to be able to access anything. And it can be transparent as well. So your ops team can say, well, the performance is not getting where we want it to be, so why don't we add a few more nodes to it? And in fact, your application will not need to make changes at that point. They just need to keep the endpoint the same, and everything happens behind the scenes.
Yeah, it's just interesting. So you're talking about the open source version, and obviously there's the commercial enterprise versions. Mm-hmm. So one of the major differences between the open source version and the supported version where you have enterprises more likely to pay for support?
Yeah, so the enterprise version there is a distinct difference in some of the code base, but they operate to the people who are writing applications the same. So there's almost no difference between writing application for open source and writing an application for enterprise. So that's the first thing it's important to know. But they differ in a couple different ways. The enterprise at its heart has individual instances of the open source. So it kind of provides a management layer on top of the open source. That's why we maintain full compatibility. But the other difference is how the kind of architecture of the cluster itself. In open source, you generally have this idea of having these kind of very smart clients that do a lot of things if you want to cluster something out. That does actually limit what you can do with it. These clients have very strict requirements as far as the way in which you access your data. And they basically, you have independent nodes that each manage their own, and you have to do anything else that is completely oblivious to any infrastructure behind the scenes. So it doesn't necessarily know that it's running in a cloud instance. It doesn't necessarily know about availability zones or rack awareness or anything like that. So enterprise, on the other hand, works on a proxy model where you have a number of nodes, each having their own proxy layer, which you can connect to. And every node is a shared nothing node. And so inside the cluster, they can actually talk. You're talking to individual proxies, but the proxies then know the topology of the cluster, and they know in what kind of environments they're set up in. So in that case, it may be able to set it up where you wouldn't have a replica and a master on the same physical VM, right? Or in the same physical rack, in case you want to harden to any problems with that particular rack. So that's the differences when it comes to kind of architecture. There's other features that Enterprise has, for example, like active-active geodistribution. So you can have kind of peer clusters that you can write to in different geographies, and they'll resolve any conflicts between them. That's an enterprise-only feature. But for the most part, the features tend to reside more, there's a parity among those from how you're writing your application. The only other feature that we have that's different in how you might immediately see things, of course, there's features in enterprise that are important for certain circumstances, but the other feature that's kind of the bigger one is Redis on Flash, and what that allows you to do is to tier your storage. So you have a hot tier and a cold tier, and that way you can store, you know, hundreds and hundreds of terabytes without having to actually have hundreds and hundreds of terabytes of RAM, which would be kind of frightfully expensive for most people.
Yeah, so Chris, I was thinking of Redis in the future, and databases of this type in the future, running on systems with storage class memory. This really becomes a very powerful system, and performance will be should be quite spectacular when we start getting servers with much larger storage class memories as their tier zero storage.
Yeah, that's a good point, because obviously anybody who's got any sort of awareness of, we talk about storage class on persistent memory quite a lot. Mm-hmm. We know that that's going to give you persistence even if you turn off the power. So theoretically, you could, as long as the node doesn't crash and you've got resiliency across nodes for hardware failure, you don't need to actually be flushing to disk regularly. So that might be an interesting approach going forward. Kyle, does that change the model in any way, the way that Redis works, if we suddenly had persistent memory to be able to store all this data?
Well, you know, we were a partner with Intel when they were doing Optane persistent memory, and we've done a lot of work with Intel on this, and to a degree, it does change somewhat of what we're doing. You know, this is something that is something that definitely that we're extremely interested in, as you might imagine, because you know, we believe the world is moving away from anything that would resemble a spinning disk, right? Like that's pretty much something that will exist in a certain degree, but it's kind of starting to move towards the way that we started viewing tape drives, right? Like it might be something for a disaster recovery situation in the future. And everything will be silicon, and it will be something like addressable by bytes. And when that comes, I think that Redis is really poised to be in a really great situation here, because byte addressable memory means we'll just be able to take a huge, giant amount of memory as that price goes down and be able to use that just like we would any other type of memory on the system.
I just think it maybe changes the programming model from your perspective a little bit, because now you don't have to be thinking about consistency in terms of flushing it to disk and keeping all of those disk copies as consistent as you would do if it's just one copy in memory. So it might actually have a double effect, in the sense that you don't have to maybe add some of the journaling or some other features in it. So as you said, it's going to be very interesting to see how that turns out.
You know, it's what I think will be really interesting on this is what's going to happen to how memory is being perceived on cloud virtual machines. The majority of our customers run on the cloud. Of course, when you're dealing with persistent storage on the cloud, you're dealing with something that is effectively a network attached storage. When persistent memory comes in, you know, there's always this opportunity where, you know, you don't own the VM, you don't know anything about the thing that's happening under the scenes. at the cloud provider, so they can, you know, kick you out at any point and kill your virtual machine. What happens to persistent memory at that point? And that's an important question. How are they going to provide some sort of persistency from, you know, failures in that regard? So in some ways, I think that it will change some things. In other ways, I think it won't. Because until they can provide guarantees that if you write something to that persistent memory and there's a failure, that they'll be able to restore you back on that actual VM, that's when they'll have that. But I don't know if cloud providers are going to be providing those type of guarantees in the near term on persistent memory.
Yeah, that's a fair point.
Chris, I was thinking it actually for a long time. We have talked about composable infrastructures as well. I think tools like Redis really fall into the concept of this composable infrastructure, where you have your compute and you want to scale up your memory asymmetrically, maybe off of a different node. You can see how these modern applications, modern infrastructure applications, can retake advantage of some of these things which are coming along, like the composable infrastructures.
Yeah, that is true. And, you know, we haven't touched on the idea of what happens when a node runs out of memory, or, you know, scalability issues, because I'm sure we could spend probably an hour talking about just that. But from that point of view, Martin, I think you're right in the sense that if you could dynamically add in memory, even if it wasn't directly connected into the server and it was through some of the new technologies that we're seeing coming out, like CXL and so on, that definitely would give you some really interesting scalability capabilities, which would be very different to the way we do it today. But you are right, it's poised to be something really, really interesting. I mean, obviously, it's already something interesting, but it's poised to be even more interesting as those technologies develop.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay, so let's quickly go on and talk about how somebody might actually program to this, because we've talked before about different database technologies, and we know that, for instance, a lot of vendors have got SDKs, or they've got their own SQL languages, or you've got other forms of query that you can do. How does it work with key value in Redis particularly?
Yeah, so that's a good question. Redis works on the idea of having commands. The commands basically inform how the data will be written or retrieved from a particular point in memory. So we have a number of different data types or data structures. We kind of use that term interchangeably. Once you start it down a road on a particular data structure, by adding data to it, there's no usually instantiation step that you need to provide. Once you just kind of start writing to it, and those commands then are able to be understood, and you can use other commands to, let's say you write to it, then you would read from it with a similar set of commands that are all kind of in the same thing. We have client libraries in you know, dozens of languages. It's something where many languages have multiples, and almost any language now has a Redis client library. The serialization protocol is quite simple. It's called RESP, R-E-S-P. And it's something that personally I've deployed the client library on a microcontroller with 64 kilobytes of RAM. So it is really almost no overhead. It's a persistent connection that you make with the Redis connection, with the Redis server. That connection stays valid and alive through the entire lifecycle of the application. And then data can be retrieved synchronously from that. And so you can have things from, like I said, something like a very tiny IoT device that's the size of your thumbnail, all the way up to you know, massive farms of servers that are accessing, you know, every machine in the rack is accessing maybe a different part of the cluster.
Have you got application examples where people are writing data, IoT type data, into something as an edge device that is then synchronized back into a core or into the cloud?
Yeah, absolutely. We part of the EdgeX foundation, the EdgeX system uses Redis intrinsically. They were actually replaced. There was Mongo in the past, and now it's using Redis. But certainly, we have individual applications that are using this for collecting information, temperatures, and things like that, kind of traditional IoT things. But we even have things that are doing more advanced types of things. There's a company that is using it to power robotics. So everything actually goes through Redis, and it uses some of our data types as the primary interface to the robotics. And then we actually have a company as well that uses it as part of an AI-driven baby monitor. So these devices will send it as an edge device and send the information back to a centralized server where the processing may occur. Whether that be a robot, for example, doing some sort of vision processing, and then the commands are sent via the centralized server back through to Redis and the robots moving, or data is being collected by the individual device and then being sent for processing and maybe alerting a different part of the application somewhere else, in the case of the baby monitor. So certainly it's used very frequently in IoT.
Okay. One thing that just sprung to mind there was that whole idea then of security, because clearly when you've got data being created in multiple places and you want to sync it, security is an issue. But I know that there's an ability to have data that actually has a finite lifetime as well within the product. And that side of it interests me, about that concept of creating data that you deliberately expire. Now, the most obvious place I can see there is if you've got session data that you want to expire after a certain length of time. You know, somebody logs off and you expire it after 10 minutes. That's a really obvious use case. But what else would you sort of use that feature for?
Yeah, so there's lots of different things that you can use it for. So we have a couple different things to think about as far as how data actually leaves the system. You have things as like eviction policies. So in that case, it's actually kind of managing the memory itself. So it would take something that is least frequently used or least recently used and can evict that. So that's one way. But the way you're referring to is the time to live. So that data is marked as data that can be basically freed after a given amount of time. So you can say, I want this data to live for a millisecond, something that short, or many minutes or days or whatever you'd like. And in that case, then the system will free up memory as needed from that kind of a collection of data that now is considered to be timed out. And so you see a lot of patterns coming out of that, whether that be some things like rate limiting or providing different access patterns where you want to only enable access to something for a given amount of time, then you can provide those TTLs that will enable something, and then after a while it will say, okay, well, let's say we've given you try to access an API too many times, then the rate limiting the TTL and the rate limiting will say, okay, you haven't accessed it for a while, so now you can access it again. Or for example, you only have access to a given resource for a certain amount of time, so you just expire that and say, I want a month. Or every time you access it, you then kind of push the can down the road.
So it's sort of like, I know we talked at the very beginning of this, we talked about state, and we talked about the idea that you've got to put state somewhere. Pretty much what you're almost implying is that you've got variable state there, where you want to actually sometimes absolutely definitely always have the state, mm-hmm. and sometimes you want to throw the state away and decide that state is now not relevant and I'm starting again from scratch. So that's a really I think that's a really interesting use of the stateful process in that sense. And it's making me think of that, so many, as you said, so many interesting ways of using this, but so many other ways you could do it as well. I think that's a really fascinating different programming model that is different to the way I may have thought about it before. Really, really interesting.
Yeah, you see a lot of people coming to us for those very use cases where they need something to only exist for a while, or they don't care about it after a while. Like I said, session state, you don't really care about something. A user that hasn't accessed a particular service in a few days, well, you can go ahead and not worry about that. But a user that's accessing every 30 seconds, you have a good feel that they're going to continue to do so. And then maybe later on, they'll go out to not having access to it again. We see this a lot in our users of who were used widely in the gaming industry. So, mobile gaming and things like that. They may be working and playing on their device, and then they have to go to an appointment or something. Well, what will happen is that will just be expired after, 30 seconds of inactivity. And then when they need it again, they can either pull it back from some other data store, or you can have something like I was telling earlier with flash memory, where you basically that's automatically shuffled off into some slower, flash-based memory. And then when the user comes back online, then they can, we'll repopulate that automatically.
So I think, Kyle, from my perspective, that makes me feel like I want to go off and have a play and try it out and just see how we get on with it.
It'll be a lot of fun when you do, so I encourage you to do so.
Yeah, so how can anybody who's listening to what we're talking about go off and try this out themselves?
Yeah, sure. Go to redislabs.com, and what you can do, you can actually go and get a free instance of it on the cloud. That's probably the easiest way to do it. So you would just go in. It's a smaller instance, but it'll allow you to kind of play with it and understand the data structure. So I think it's 30 megabytes for free, but that's for life. So you could use it for as long as you keep it active. If you want to download it for your own machine, redis.io we're open source, we're BSD licensed, so you can go and look at the source, which is great. Or you can download the binaries as well, or build it from source, whatever you'd like to do. I'm a build from source type of guy, so I always like to look at the source when I don't understand something.
That's always a good way to go and find out, isn't it? See how somebody actually wrote it.
Yep.
So, Kyle, that sounds great. Obviously, I'd recommend people go and have a look and try it out and see what they think. And I'll be doing that personally. But for now, I think, thanks very much for your time. And look forward to going and having a play and see what I can learn.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to Storage Unpacked. For show notes and more, subscribe at storageunpacked.com. Follow us on Twitter at Storage Unpacked or join our LinkedIn group by searching for Storage Unpacked Podcast. You can find us on all good podcatchers, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. Thanks for listening.